kids. Matt Segundo here, and I must point out that I am unfamiliar with the workings of Washington. You see, there once was a night in 1987 in which I was invited, for some unknown reason, to a social function and asked to shake a senator's hand. Hoping to break the ice, I made some harmless remark about the senator's wife's anatomy. The senator, unfortunately, didn't care for my witticism, and I was escorted out of the building, ordered by several large men to play an impromptu game they called Human Pinata, and woke up the next morning with bruises all over my body. Let this be a lesson to novelists like Sue Miller, who are rash, impetuous, and who pursue this controversial subject with their own hapless folly.
Okay, I'm here with Sue Miller, who is the author, most recently, of The Senator's Wife. Sue, how are you doing?
I'm sort of sweating it out. I'm on tour, but I'm glad to be here having a cup of coffee and stopping for a minute.
That's good. That's good. You got 14 cities on this tour, so hopefully there's some stop along the carousel.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wanted to first of all ask you about the character names in this book. They were very interesting to me.
The names,
uh-huh. Yes, because you have Mary for the token marriage exemplar. You have the kid is named Asa, which is a palindrome, and I was very curious about that. And I was also very curious also about the name Tom Naughton, as if to imply that he is naughty. So there's something to these names, and I wanted to find out how these came to be.
You know, they're much more whimsical than you would think. I have a terrible time conjuring names. Delia, to me, seemed like an old sort of New England-y kind of name, and a logical name for her to have. Tom, I just was sort of, I don't know where that name came from, actually.
I was thinking Tom Hayden or something, because he has the whole New Left thing going.
Yeah, no, he's older than Hayden by quite a bit, you know, a different era, really. And I was actually, when I was doing research for the book, read a bio of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, because I sort of thought of Tom, this character, who's a senator, as being of sort of that political stripe, a liberal who had trouble in the 60s and the 70s with the way the democratic liberal world changed and became radicalized, and the sort of many pipers that you had to dance to, essentially, which he is good at but not great at, doesn't love. So Asa, I like because you can call him Ace, which his brother does. But it was, and Mary I thought of as a, you know, it's her nickname, but I, quite honestly, they just seemed interesting to me.
The marriage connotation had not occurred to you?
It had not occurred to me at all.
Interesting. Interesting. Even with Naughton, too.
No. It's all up to you, but whatever you want to put in it is fine.
It's so there, though, you know?
Well, absolutely. If you think it's there, it's there.
Okay, fair enough,
And I'll take credit for it, too.
Okay, sure. No, it was your great genius that concocted this. Well, actually, I also wanted to ask you about why you set this in the early years of Clinton. I mean, aside, of course, from the fact that this is kind of pre-Lewinsky, and also during some of the early scandals like Paula Jones and Jennifer Flowers, was there a sort of Clintonian vibe that sort of you naturally kind of were directed to with this narrative?
Or? It was less that, actually, although it was interesting to pick up on him as a character who hadn't sort of stepped beyond the pale yet, and to have Tom and Delia talk about him at that stage in his extramarital career. But it also had to do with wanting to place Tom at a certain point politically. And so in order to do that and have the ages work out, I mean, sort of do the chronology of the book.
So it was basically crunching numbers then.
Yes, it was. But I was very glad to come up, not to have to have Monica Lewinsky be in it. I mean, not to have to deal with that overt kind of comparison with Tom's behavior, but just have Clinton be more the same type in a certain sense without having this sort of definable, quite, sort of startling and kind of public. I didn't want to have the contrast, I guess, between the public infidelity of Clinton and the more private infidelity of Tom.
Gotcha.
Although I was very interested in that world that Tom and Delia lived in, where an infidelity could be kept more or less private. That is to say, people would know about it, but they wouldn't write about it in the papers, and they wouldn't openly talk about it, just before the era where I think Gary Hart beckoned everybody forward and changed everything. The rules all changed after that. And we began to, and I think the rules about privacy in general, that was sort of a tipping point, and it just cascaded into this whole new universe of all new rules about what's private and what's public.
Well, there's also a sort of pragmatism to setting it in that time, because it's pre-internet, and it also allows Delia to begin a radio career. So I was wondering if this was also a consideration as well.
Yeah, I mean, the era is easier for me to write about in a certain way, because I'm such a, you know, I've talked about this with other writers my age, sort of how difficult it is for us to move forward into the new sort of technological era, because we're not there. We don't have it. I remember reading about Updike's book, The Terrorist, and I guess I didn't read the book actually, but various reviews talked about his attempt to really make this kid really seem like a contemporary kid, and his failure to do so. And I think I suspect I would have some of the same difficulties. I felt, while I had a kid living more or less at home, or at least coming home from college and drifting in and out of my life, that I was in touch more with the contemporary world, but I feel I've just fallen out of it, actually.
Well, you could always get up to speed, though. I'm wondering if there's why this reticence continues. I mean, a lot of other writers who are older, without trying to sort of discredit or anything here, they manage to still tackle the realities of contemporary internet and all that kind of jazz. I mean, why do you just want to dwell upon this particular age in your books and your stories?
It's not a wish to dwell upon it particularly. It's just a reluctance to, I think, undertake this new thing in a certain way on my part. Okay. And that limits me in a certain way. Although I'm now working on a new book, and it is set in contemporary times, so I'll have to do a little something, won't I? I'll have to figure something out.
Gotcha. Yeah. The other question I wanted to ask you is the role of food in this book, which I was very fascinated by. There are specific images that are really quite interesting. For example, when you have Delia at the office party, there's a
Mary
pen
at the office party.
I'm sorry.
Mary.
Yeah. My mistake. She's at the office party, and there is a pen that invades the goat cheese, and the ink collides with the cheese, and this seemed to me a sort of pen is mightier than the canapé sort of thing. I wanted to ask you about images like that, and also, for example, when Delia is actually sitting down with her son, she's eating a hamburger. Likewise, there's a moment when Mary is actually kind of considering picking up corn. And this was interesting to me because, of course, corn was something that initially humans did not eat. It was fed to animals. And then, of course, when the Puritans came to this country, they started going ahead and munching upon corn. So with many of these observations in mind, I was wondering if food was this political metaphor or this impetus for history or whatnot. What happened here?
I think for me, it's simply a kind of way of conveying the animal life of these people. I mean, making them physically real, in effect. I mean, Delia is eating a hamburger because she's been in France for a couple of months, and she thinks of it as sort of this American dish that she's yearned for, a bloody, fatty hamburger, and even likes the smell of the fat coming off of it as she's about to eat it. And, you know, Mary, the sort of blue, inky cheese and so forth has to do actually with sort of the ineptitude of the guy who's trying to open the goat cheese, which is in one of those tubes that won't open and which you have to pierce somehow. And he's in an office setting, so pierces it with his ballpoint pen. I mean, for me, they're sort of just physical details that seem rich and intriguing and maybe can reveal something about a person's situation, a person's yearnings, a person's thoughts in some way.
But why a pen over, say, a paperclip or a more effective, I mean, there's got to be a letter opener somewhere. So what I'm sort of suggesting here is that by using the pen, there's this metaphor that I see in terms of the overall political subtext of what's going on within these particular marriages.
Well, again, I'll take credit for it, but I didn't intend it.
Well, I mean, okay, going to this issue of Paris, this struck me as very interesting because, of course, many of the early founding fathers, they went to Paris to conduct diplomacy, to meet up with various people and the like. There's, of course, the infamous story between, you know, Adams and Ben Franklin and all that. Was Paris kind of considered along these lines? How much of American history were you considering when you were making specific artistic choices for a lot of this imagery?
I actually did think about sort of Paris in that sense and thought about, you know, writing something about it, but just didn't. But I did sort of think about actually also the kind of sense of an older world, a more decorous world in a certain way, a world more ruled by convention and rules, essentially, in Europe than in the States, and Delia's greater comfort in that older version of life, in a version of life that is more, allows more for privacy, and in fact encourages privacy. I was thinking actually in some ways of the difference between sort of the French way of dealing with this issue of infidelity among public figures, and although now, of course, that's changing with Sarkozy, but but prior to him, you know, with Mitterrand, who had a whole second life that was never reported until after his death, essentially, that Delia would feel more comfortable in that universe, and that would be a universe of sort of customs and habits that was, that she would feel utterly safe in, utterly private in a way that she couldn't in the States.
But what struck me, for example, about her indecision with the corn is that, well, in a certain way, she is very much subscribing to rules that are perhaps even more diabolical than Europe. I mean, everything in this book is all about saving face. Everything in this book is all about conforming to what it, you must appear to be like an American. And this brings me into, well, I will go into examples on that later, but I really wanted to ask you about the use of italics. You have one moment where Delia sails through the door as Mary opens it. Mm-hmm. And this was interesting to me because most of the italics you use are within, like, internal thought and dialogue. But in this instance, you actually italicize sail.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to ask you about the use of italics. In fact, it's a very interesting sequence, that, because in the dialogue you have sort of this emphatical interplay between Delia and Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and they're both kind of riffing off of each other. First, you know, we have the old world emphasis of various phrases and things like that, and then Mary starts using the emphasis too in terms of italics in the dialogue. So how did this come about, and why did you decide we've sailed to put the italics there?
I think in part because then Mary goes on to say that she hadn't understood, I mean, to sort of isolate it as a word, because Mary goes on to say that she had not yet ever before quite understood how a human being could be said to sail.
Yeah.
And Delia, in fact, does seem to sail. So I wanted to sort of point to it as a word which Mary is finally understanding the usage of in this context.
But, and I got that, too.
Yeah.
But I mean, to sort of pound the point home, you italicized it, too. So I'm wondering why you decided to go that one step further. Because in relation to the dialogue, it becomes rather striking because it's outside quotes and it's outside thought.
Mm-hmm. I can only explain it that way, just to sort of say it was to emphasize it as a particular word that Mary is thinking of and then explains to herself.
Gotcha.
And I'm not sure about the exchanges that they have in which there are italics. I'm not sure which ones you're talking about. And
it's right in that scene. It's that whole scene afterwards in which there's just slight use of italics in various quotes that they're saying. And then you have like one every page, and then all of a sudden becomes two every page as they start to kind of bounce around. I mean, what is the sort of,
For me,
criteria?
I think probably most of it is a control issue as a writer. I suspect it's just that I heard a certain emphasis on those words when I was imagining the dialogue, so that it's auditory. It's a signal to you that this is the way they're emphasizing the word, essentially. So I want you to hear it in a certain way. I had an editor once who said I overused italics and that I should trust people to hear the dialogue the way I wrote it. If I wrote it well enough, I wouldn't need to use italics. But he's no longer my editor. So clearly I've slipped back into this terrible habit.
Wow, the editor is actually in the East River now? What happened with that?
Oh, no, he retired.
Oh.
He's a wonderful...
It was amicable.
Yes, it was very amicable.
Nobody got hurt.
I adore him.
Yeah.
And he was a terrific editor, Ted Solotaroff is his name. He's still writing essays and memoirs and things like that, but he did retire at a certain point.
The book of On Poverty that Nathan writes is, to me, very symptomatic of his inability to look beyond what's in front of him, what's immediately in front of him for sort of larger issues. Likewise with of course, Tom as well. That's the case, too. And I'm wondering if this was intended as a kind of wry interplay between what these two couples cannot see readily in front of them in terms of...
Well, I actually thought of both Tom and Nathan as rather more thoughtful people than that. I mean, I think Tom's book, Nathan's book, rather, is meant to be a pretty, both theoretical, but then also based in these interviews with these people, study of the sort of the result of the various poverty programs that people are dealing with, and a kind of examination of the ways in which they've, the poverty programs themselves have failed people, have failed to work for them. And I don't see his vision of that as being particularly limited in any way. I do think everyone in this book struggles to sort of see around himself, that is this, everyone's selves sort of get in the way of their being able truly to interact with anyone else. And even understanding themselves is hard for people. So that for me, in a certain way, it was a an examination of, and if you see the books as, and the politics as working this way, I mean, you might make that analogy, but for me it was an examination of the sort of limitations of our abilities to really connect with each other. And the even with the best of intentions and with the sort of open-heartedness or attempt at open-heartedness, the great difficulty of that, of finally really being able to tell someone else what you feel and who you are and to represent that to them in any way. That
I suppose I see a parallel, because there are so many doubles throughout the book. And I'm wondering, I wanted to ask you about that. Why did doubles in this particular book appeal to you more than other books that you've wrote? Because it's just, we have, from the very get-go, we have the home that is bifurcated, that they move into. I mean, and there's just so many similarities, even talking about this interviewing. Well, Mary does a lot of interviews for her particular show, too, which is why I sort of see that. So what of this?
The doubling. I think I started it, the book came from a sort of impulse and a note that I had to myself, actually, which was about, there are two people I know, I don't know them well, they're acquaintances rather than friends, my age, which is in the mid-60s, who have taken in divorced or estranged spouses as they grew ill in their old age and lived with them and helped them until their death. And that seemed so interesting to me and so compelling to someone from who, I mean, they were amicable separations and divorces. It wasn't as though people hated each other, but still to re-enter that relationship in this very caring way. And as I was thinking about, you know, what I might sort of want to do with that fictionally, it occurred to me this sort of way in which one physically cares for someone who's ill allows for a great deal of lovingness, that one comes to lovingness through the body, was my thought. And then I was thinking the other time one does this is when a child is very little, and when you learn to love a child essentially by taking care of its body, by ministering to all of its little bodily needs. So it occurred to me to do this parallel thing, to have these two women at the sort of the beginning of a marriage and at the end of a marriage, each of them taking care of a dependent creature and feeling one way or another around the issue of love.
That's extremely interesting that you would say that, because there is one thing I wanted to ask you about in relation to Mary and the writing program that she actually conducts these interviews for. You have the narration dwelling on the most beautiful boy, a Hispanic kid who had the slow, beatific smile of an angel, and as if the physical characteristics of this kid are more important than anything he writes. And here you are talking to me about the body, and I wanted to sort of ask you about how much this was embedded within the narrative to sort of demonstrate that really it's kind of about either not seeing beyond what's in front of you. This is why I'm so obsessed with this particular motif. And but it also struck me as a kind of wry statement on perhaps white liberal guilt. Maybe you can discuss this a little bit more.
I don't connect it. I mean, I don't connect the sort of focus on the physical with liberal guilt, and I don't quite see how one would make the connection. I mean, I do think...
well, he's a Hispanic kid, that's why I sort of suggest, so...
I don't think she feels guilt at all about what she's doing there. I mean, I think she's reporting on it, she's sort of looking at it, she's interested in it, she's interested in this new life she's making for herself, which is the life of the radio, essentially, and the kind of way it opens up an infinite number, not infinite, but a lot of doors to various ways of living, various aspects of the world around her in this community. But I don't think she has even a smidgen of liberal guilt at this, at going in to look at this prison writing program. I mean, I think she's...
But she's dwelling upon the physical form of this kid more than anything he writes about. She mentioned something about him writing about alcohol, but she's more taken, or at least the narration is more taken with the way the
Oh, I think it's
looks.
Very much that he's just this beautiful, sweet, innocent-looking kid who writes this elegant thing about his addiction. It seems a very compelling contrast, in fact, the way he looks, which is lovely and angelic, and then this sort of, you know, he's the best writer in the group, but he writes about essentially his addiction to alcohol in this very interesting way. So I think it's the combination of things, the sort of surprise of finding within this sweet, childlike looking person this dark, hard story that he's telling, and that interests her, that's compelling to her, as I think it would be to most people, that he is sort of the most interesting of this group because of this, A, because he's the best writer in the group, but B, because he's writing about this thing which his face seems to belie, his demeanor, the way he carries himself, and just the nature of his beauty seems to belie.
But because that is a clause embedded within commas within the sentence, I sort of see this a little differently in the sense that, oh, well, she is kind of incapable of seeing, maybe this is kind of a half glasses, half empty sort of perception of the sentence, but since the prioritization of this quality over the fact that he's writing about something really sad about addiction, it almost sort of sees that she's unwilling to sort of see the complexity of this kid, that there's a lot going on in him. And so I guess because the book is so built around this idea of, to me anyway, how one looks and how one looks upon life, I'm wondering about sort of prioritizations like this.
I see them as sort of equal value. I mean, I see that to me, is what compels her about it, is the combination of these two things. And I don't see her as sort of dwelling on one over the other.
Okay, yeah. Okay, fair enough. I actually wanted to ask you, going back to the idea of Clinton and this notion that Tom expresses of, if you're a Republican, you sleep up, and if you're a Democrat, you sleep down. This is particularly creepy in light of what you reveal in the end of the book, and I don't want to spoil it, but I wanted to ask you how this philosophy sort of came to be in Tom, and how it was epitomized with this. Surely you didn't get this from reading the Moynihan.
No, I didn't get it from reading about Daniel Patrick Moynihan, but it's in fact something I've sort of a Washington truism, and it sort of was floating around at the time of the senior George Bush, who was reputed to have a mistress, but she was reputed to look just like Barbara, and she was also, you know, Episcopalian, and therefore, you know, wouldn't be like Clinton's mistresses, who sort of sold their stories to the National Enquirer or wherever it was that Jennifer Flowers sold her story to. I mean, who were interested in making something out of the stories. So it's a sort of an old saw, essentially, that he's repeating in a sort of witty way. But you know, in his wit, he doesn't understand that he's hurting, you know, that there's something quite painful in this for his wife, and and that Mary, because she's done this illicit thing by reading the letters between Tom and his wife, knows that this would be painful to Delia. So it was a way of sort of getting at all of that in this scene by having him say this thing, which I also thought would be in and of itself an engaging surface, let's say, that the reader would be amused by and entertained by, and then would sort of present an opportunity without pointing at it too directly to sort of show these other aspects of what was going on with other people in that scene.
Well, and it's also tied into this notion of privacy with Delia's sexual watercolors, as they are described in the book. There is a moment where she describes this, and this is why I was so obsessed with food. You specifically use the word appetite in this sentence. An appetite, she thought of it that way. This wish to know more, and then more than that, about Delia's life. Mm-hmm. So this suggests to me that this kind of hunger is essentially basically motivating everything in this particular book. And I wanted to ask you about how... Maybe I'm looking at the food thing far too crazily here, but...
I think Mary is in particular a very hungry character, and she, you know, characterizes herself elsewhere as, you know, being like Goldilocks going in and, you know, as we know, eating all these different kinds of porridge, also sleeping in all the different beds. But to me, she was the most driven by appetite, and then she makes a connection between herself and Tom. So I saw a sort of parallel between her and Tom, that they were, she sees herself as entering a sort of a bourgeois world that she's not entirely sure she wants to enter. She sees herself as coming from another kind of background, which she does come from, which is also true for Tom. He's thoroughly entered it and mastered it, and is, you know, rides on top of it, essentially. And Mary's in a different position vis-a-vis it, but she is a very... in some ways desperate person as the book starts, I think. Very unsure that she's going to be able to do what she's undertaken to do with her marriage. And she sees Delia as someone who might somehow help her, who might be of use to her, who might in some way be mother-like in some way she doesn't fully understand. Mary doesn't fully understand, but she wants something from her. And it's that kind of hunger that drives her towards Delia and that makes her feel rebuffed by Delia when Delia's very sense of reserve and privacy seems to sort of pull a curtain or draw a line that she can't get across. So.
But in tying in this class mobility in light of what Tom is saying, it becomes a little bit creepier when you think if music be the food of love or lust, play on, you know? So what of this relationship between appetite and class mobility? Or am I, again, just perhaps inferring? I just see that there's a lot of thematic connections when we, either that or we just seem to be on the same page, or I'm perceiving a little bit more here.
I think that they are both hungrier people than Nathan and Delia, who are more sort of entitled people. They're people who come from a certain class and have a lot of sort of assurance in their background, you know. Well-loved, well-protected, moneyed in a certain way. Not wealthy, but comfortable. Always been comfortable.
But it's also a little sort of disturbing in light of the idea of if you are a reformer or a Democrat, you are sort of attracted to those who are down, as opposed to sort of looking at it from a more egalitarian base, which sort of suggests that any ability to kind of negotiate the crazed plane of life is going to be compromised by this attitude of being in a particular stature of class.
Mm-hmm. I don't think, though, that fiction makes rules like that. It sort of observes particular characters. It invents particular characters. And I don't think you're meant to say, well, because this character behaves this way, what the writer is saying is that all people behave this way. I don't think that's it at all. I think, people work with very particular people. It's their job to invent these particular people, and they're not meant to represent a class of people or a gender. You know, all men are like this. Not at all. It's simply that they are who they are. They come from the very particular background they come from. They bring with them the very particular needs that they have, and there is no rule that you can extract from that about people in general or people in general who are, you know, come from whatever town in Illinois Mary comes from. She is who she is. She had the particular mother and particular father she had, and that made her a particular way, just as Delia is particular. And I think that wish to make a rule out of fiction is misguided. I really feel that.
Well, it's not necessarily making a rule out of fiction. Essentially, what we're talking about here is this great prism known as the novel, and here you are making specific decisions as the author, mm-hmm. and this is the communicative conduit with which you reach the reader. Mm-hmm. So, some things the reader is going to possibly detect on his own, and some things you can kind of control, like, for example, the italics that we were discussing before. That's a very specific choice that calls attention to itself. When do you kind of throw yourself into a choice, like something with the italics, and when do you decide, I'll leave it a little ambiguous so that the reader can kind of ferret out a particular detail or come to some perception based off of what I presented?
I think I try to always step back. I mean, I try to err on that side of sort of stepping back from making things crystal clear, which may, you know, my notes to myself may be sharper and more pointed than what I present on the page. You know, I want there always to be room for the reader to enter the book, you know, not to feel as though it's something entirely laid out and entirely actually thought out, in fact, in a certain way, although I have, you know, thought it out in my own terms. But I want to make sure that it stays open, that there's kind of a hole in it, as it were, that yeah. for people in which people through which people can enter it. So, you know, I think that my tendency is to sort of have thought things through and then to try to present what seemed to me to be this sort of embodiment of those thoughts, to have people behave in certain ways which might make the reader feel the way I felt when I wrote it, but might not. Yeah. I mean, depending on what the reader brings to it.
Well, how loose do you keep things? I mean, did you know the denouement going into this particular book?
Yes, I did, yeah. I mean, I always feel as though what I'm doing when I'm writing a book is making a whole thing. And so I want to know where I'm going to end up. Because I feel as though if I just sort of amble along and write this and write that and write that and then sort of figure a way for it to all come to an end, it's not self-contained. It's sort of, you know, a kind of quixotic, narrative-based thing. And I want it to sort of have a kind of integrity and wholeness. So I always know where I'm going. There certainly are always a lot of surprises and a lot of, detours and that sort of thing. But I always do end up where I plan to end up. And that, for me, is the point of writing the whole thing. So that it's my wish that that at the end it seems sort of inevitable that we ended up here, that it seems that this is in a certain way that the reader might feel, oh, yeah, probably when she was doing this, she was thinking, you know, whatever. I mean, that it would seem logical and inevitable without seeming predictable. And that's always the goal, I think.
Nabokov had a rule that he has set whenever he wrote a book or a story, and he said that he could not write anything until he actually knew the lay of the land, the environment, the topography. Mm-hmm. And since there is a great concern for environment in your books, I'm wondering if you approach it this way or if you allow your gestation period, so to speak, is more based on story, and the actual act of writing is more about capturing and figuring out and fleshing out this environment.
I think I ask myself to sort of understand the environment before I begin to. I make a lot of notes before I start to write, and even then when I'm writing, I continue to make notes. I mean, I'll sort of stop and say, okay, you want this to be this way, and sort of, so in I write in longhand to the first draft, so that interspersed with sort of sections which will become the text when they're typed in, are sort of notes to myself that go around the side and the bottom and so forth. And so there's a lot of, I mean, I feel as though, I mean, I write in longhand in some ways because it seems very provisional to me and very generous. It allows me to not feel that I'm doing a finished product, but that I can kind of be very fluid in terms of what I'm doing. So that it's a combination of writing and note-taking, in fact, the first draft. But I certainly, you know, was very conscious of the physical universe these people inhabited. And even, I have drawings of the shape of the interiors of their houses.
Oh, really?
So
okay.
It would all be logical and no one could, the staircase would be in a certain place. So, I mean, so that I wouldn't construct something that would be a physical impossibility, as the house was described in some other scene. You know, I mean, I sort of feel responsible for understanding pretty fully.
Are these interior doodles on the side of the page as well? I mean, if so, you've got quite an archive to give to some university.
Yeah, no, they're right there in the middle of the page.
Oh, wow.
And they're sort of various versions of it. I mean, I had trouble working out exactly how these houses would have this party wall and then have these rooms, but it was sort of architecturally interesting to do. So I do, in fact, feel as though the physical surround is something I very much want to know. And the town, really sort of based on a particular town in Massachusetts. And the main street was very familiar to me, and the campus and so forth. So.
Now, given that you're going from this rather almost abstract manuscript, essentially, and taking this and putting it into a computer, perhaps, or a typewriter, I'm not sure what you're using, but I'm curious as to how that process works in relation to this, because here you have something in which anything goes, essentially. Mm-hmm. How do you corral that into another draft that is readable for, because I'm sure that, you know, Knopf, as good as they are not going to take a...
No, never. But I type it in, and if I have sort of left a blank spot, I leave some room on the page to write that in now, so that if I sort of haven't quite made something happen in a scene, but said to myself, you need to have him da-da-da-da here, I just type that in so that I'll remember and leave enough space for that to happen. So it's a very sort of physical engagement with it. And then, you know, I pull it out, print it out, and write in longhand all over it again. So there... It just goes back in and comes out, goes back in and comes out, goes back in and comes out.
So really, it's really a matter of just essentially just constantly scribbling over it until it's right then.
Yeah, it's sort of, I feel as though it's like drawing, you know, that someone would, or actually maybe painting, that you would sort of initially just gesturally have it. And then you would sort of slowly add more and more and sort of ask yourself what you needed in this area and what you needed in this area and moving around in that way. And some of it's a very refined kind of just, you know, changing a few words in a sentence, and some of it is writing a whole new passage over here that sort of gets at somebody's motivation for doing something within the book. But it's a very gradual accumulation of materials is the way I look at it. And for me, that's some of the pleasure of writing, is that it is gradual, and I can feel that I'm always working on it at all, you know, that there's never sort of a whole draft like this, da-da-da-da, and this clean, and then I'm doing just a little bit of revision here and there. I feel as though I'm always working on all of it, which is a very, for me, sort of fundamental feeling about writing a book.
Gotcha. Well, Sue, I have tons of questions, but I'm going to get in trouble if I don't get you back. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. Whoa.